T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Now, with the MLB app, you can get baseball your way. Pick your favorite team, your favorite players, and get customized highlights, stories, and breaking news right on your home feed. Follow the action with Game Day, where 3D replays add another dimension. Plus, notifications can keep you connected to every pitch, every hit, every game. The MLB app. Baseball, your way. Download it now for free from the App Store or Google Play. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
Welcome back inside the clubhouse, Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score. I'm David Hall with Bruce Levine. Thank you for joining us on this Saturday morning, the middle of January. We're still talking baseball as we do 52 Saturdays every week of the year. And it is time now, we have a special guest to go out to our guest hotline on the Circa Resort and Casino in Las Vegas, home of the world's largest sports book. That's where we find the highly respected, highly skilled senior baseball writer for The Athletic, Jason Stark, the 2019 Spink Award winner. Good morning, Jason. Thank you for joining us this morning.
David, Bruce, how are you guys? What's the temperature in Chicago right now? What do you think?
Well, we are probably 20s, mid-20s. There's a little snow on the way. It's not terrible, but it has been worse, but it could get better, Jason. It's a typical January Saturday in Chicago.
We're at 16 where I live, but this is a reminder, men, that we need to get this lockout settled. And you know why? Because pitchers and catchers has never been more important to us.
Absolutely. Pitchers and catchers report, not pitchers and catchers reject. And yet that's what happened the other day, the first bargaining session in 43 days, Jason. What is the right way, the proper context to put what happened on Thursday into perspective as we look ahead with a little bit of optimism that I think feels like a little bit of pessimism?
Well, David, I'm still scarred from covering this strike in 1994 and 1995. I spent way too many days traveling around covering talks that went nowhere, but I did learn a lot from doing that. And one of the things that I learned was it's so tempting to do play-by-play like it's a game, right, or even like it's a tennis match because, you know, the ball keeps bounding over the net one direction or the other direction. And it's just so tempting to look at a session that lasts an hour, players then express unhappiness, frustration, and you're thinking, boy, this is going nowhere. But my thing is, you should always take a step back. And if you take a step back, you realize, in my mind, looking at what the owners proposed this week and what they proposed in the past, there's actually more in the way of general concepts that these two sides agree to at least be open to than there is that they have no path to a deal. And so in the big picture, I think there's a deal there to be made. I think the biggest worry that I have and a lot of people in baseball have is there's so much dysfunction in their relationship that they just can't get there.
Jason Stark, who I have been bumping into in baseball press boxes and locker rooms for 40 years, joining us on Inside the Clubhouse for the next 10 minutes, 12 minutes or so, whatever gracious amount of time he's allowed us. And Jason, I'm glad you said that, because there's, you know, I also covered that strike and spent way too much time in New York bouncing between hotels and, you know, bad food.
Good times,
and
Bruce.
It was, you're right, the scars are still there. And I have the same feeling you have, that these are real offers and real ideas that the owners are offering here. But for some reason, with all of this stuff, I still think it's about the union trying to win back two horrible losses in labor disputes or labor CBAs that got done over the past two times, and trying to make up for their losses in one labor negotiation. I wonder what your perspective is of that, and you know, the Tony Clark taking a you know, pretty much a back seat for the first time for a long time to Meyer and to Boros as far as the lead for the players' side.
Well, Bruce, I think there's a lot of truth in that. You know, these last two labor deals, we know now the owners won big. And I think there's a lot of pressure on Tony and Bruce Meyer to win this. And I think there's a lot out there that they can already sell as a win. You know, I alluded to all these things that I think they agree on or at least are open to in common. Let me just run through them. Universal DH, right? I think we know now that's going to happen. They're both cool with that. Expanded playoffs, they don't agree on how many teams should make the playoffs, but they obviously agree on that. Both sides have made proposals that include a draft lottery as a way to deal with tanking. I think we see that there's some definite path to an agreement there. Increasing the minimum payroll, don't agree on the amount, but they agree that that's an area that I think you're going to certainly see in the deal. Eliminating draft pick penalties for free agents, both agree on that. That was in the proposal that the owners made the other day. Changing the Super 2 system in some way. I don't have any common ground on what that way is, but just remember, as long as there's some agreement on the concept, there's a way to go. And then the last one that I see is the Chris Bryant service time mess. I mean, the owners keep making proposals designed to address that the union keeps rejecting. But again, like, they understand that something to that effect has to be in the deal. And so anybody who's ever been involved in negotiations knows the way they're supposed to work. You make a proposal. I say, you know what? I can't do that. My side will never do that. But what about this? And then you go back and forth till you find that sweet spot. That's where we need to get to. That's where we haven't come close to getting to so far. There has to be some momentum on that front where you're having actual meaningful dialogue.
Jason, when we talk about some of these broad concepts, I think there's a lot of attention that's always focused on the competitive balance tax, the luxury tax, if you will, and where that should be and the penalties and all of those things that come up in conversations about that. But I don't always hear so much conversation or focus on the salary cap floor. We talk about the ceiling and we maybe overlook the floor a little bit, which I think is a growing problem in Major League Baseball. And I just wonder conceptually, how will that be addressed? And is that something that is very divisive when it comes to both sides?
Yeah, that's one of the biggest areas where they don't agree. I think you're exactly right, David. You know, the union forever has taken the position that it can't agree to a payroll floor if it won't agree to a cap, because this is based on the belief in the free market system. All right, let's just accept that, even though it's a kind of a dubious position to take. What have they agreed on for like 25 years? A tax at the top for teams that go over a certain amount. Isn't the obvious solution here a tax on the other end? The teams that go under a certain amount of payroll, pick the number, 80 million, 90 million, 100 million, whatever you want to pick, whatever you can agree on. If you don't get there, you have a choice, just like the Dodgers have chosen to pay more than the threshold and pay the tax. You have a choice to go under, but if you do, there's a tax. And if you keep going under, then maybe you start losing draft picks like you do at the top, like you start losing international slot money like you do at the top. Why can't it work exactly the same way? Tell me that wouldn't work. It seems so simple to me.
Yeah, you know, Jason, you're right. I would just propose that if you put a floor in, you're gonna increase tanking to that number for a lot of teams as well if you don't address the revenue sharing issue. Okay, because
yeah, I don't think anything works. Bruce, I agree. I think a lot of these pieces of the puzzle have to fit together, but that's one piece that seems obvious, seems logical, seems so easy mm-hmm. to do.
Right. I agree with that. I just think that players feel that they are opening themselves up, players' representatives are feeling they're opening themselves up to a real cap down the line, and a fact that owners for the first time, what would you say, both of you guys, over the last 5-6 years, have really adhered to not going over $210 million. Only a couple clubs are doing it. Teams that are the huge market teams like the Yankees and the Dodgers that have a chance in their mind to win a World Series doing it. But you would really come very close to locking yourself into that dreaded, you know, salary cap that the owners have wanted for so many years.
You know, Bruce, I agree with that. And yet, in some ways, like if you want to remove all the history of baseball labor, and it'd be great if we could do that, and just start over. I actually think a system with a cap, a floor, and a sense of partnership would be so much better for the sport than what we have now. I understand why the union opposes it. I'm sure that Tony Clark and Bruce Meyer think that if they ever agreed to any form of a cap, the ghost of Marvin Miller would smite them with a lightning bolt. I understand that. Okay, but here's as you look at these two sides, what's missing? There's a sense of common purpose. There's no sense of we're in this together. There's no sense of partnership.
Yeah.
And when you have a cap system, one thing that goes with that is the players get 50% of the money, give or take a percent, right? Give or take a couple percent. And so every dollar that rolls into the sport, what do players know? They get half of it. And like right now, that's not the way this works. And because it's not the way it works, and because the percentage that's gone to players keeps declining, what does the union think? The union is so suspicious of anything that the other side proposes. And I really feel like if we could ever figure out some way to get to a greater sense of common purpose, the sport would be so much better off. And you know what? A cap would do that. It's just never going to happen with this leadership.
Joined by Hall of Fame baseball writer Jason Stark from The Athletic. Go ahead, Bruce.
Yeah, I think a kumbaya, maybe, if they all go on a retreat somewhere and, practice some forms of good spirit. Yeah, there's what you've talked about, Jason, and David and I have talked about this on our shows many times. There's this, more than distrust, there's this hate between owners and players, and the end result has been the poorest marketing of any sport in the United States for a long period of time, where owners refuse to market the stars of the game and the game itself because they're afraid what it's going to cost them when they sit down and negotiate the next $400 million contract. But that aside, I mean, your thoughts on that as we segue into the Hall of Fame talk.
Yeah, there's a lot of truth in that. And, once again, I've never grown up dreaming of a salary cap. I'm not that guy. But there's so much of what the other sports do that baseball needs to emulate. Why do you think the NBA has taken off the way it has? It's a player-driven, personality-driven sport, period. They built their sport around their stars in every way. And this is a place baseball has had such a hard time getting to. And, if you want to sell your sport, there's no better way to do it than to sell your stars, promote your stars, build around your stars. Again, I don't think this system is conducive to that, and it's just a complication that it takes so much work to overcome, and that'll be true no matter what happens in these labor talks. Just listening to you talk about they need to go on a retreat, you know, it's like there's so much mistrust there that if they agree to go on a retreat, one side would show up in Hawaii and the other side would show up in Palm Springs.
And they'd both complain about the weather, you know?
Right.
You're right. Jason, one last thing on this before we move on. I think that the conversation about what you can do about teams who aren't trying to win and how you can maybe de-incentivize the draft and in terms of not necessarily rewarding teams that finish last with high drafting first and these kinds of things. Conceptually, is that even ground that will be covered, broached, will be any they come any closer to an agreement philosophically at the end of this? Do they have to for this deal to be reached?
Yeah, since they both made proposals that included draft lottery and they just disagree on the number of teams, the union wants 8 teams in the lottery. The owners have proposed 3 teams in the lottery, and they disagree about how many years you can pick in the top 3 of the draft. There's clear agreement that that's one way to address this. I actually wrote a piece November or December. I can't remember anymore. I basically solved this. If you really want to discourage teams from losing 112 games, it's easy. Instead of awarding the top picks to those teams that lose 110 and 112 and 107, you flip it and you give the top pick to the team that comes the closest to making the playoffs but doesn't get there. And just do the draft order in that reverse order. And trust me, I've done I worked a whole bunch of different simulated drafts using that idea. It would work. I guarantee you this would work way better than a lottery of the top 3 teams. It'll never happen. Neither side is interested in it. But the reaction that I got to that piece was unbelievable because people read it, thought about it, and thought, voila, it's the answer.
Jason Stark of The Athletic, who's been covering baseball since 1979 at the major league level when he was 12 years old, joining us for a few more minutes here on Inside the Clubhouse. And Jason, all right, I'm going to reveal one of my picks, and it's idiotic even when I even talk about it. I voted for Alex Rodriguez. I did not vote for Manny Ramirez. There is no sense whatsoever that I can make out of that other than the fact that as soon as Alex Rodriguez walked into Major League Clubhouse, he was a dominant player. And that is the reason I voted for him. But help me out. Why doesn't the Hall of Fame give a guideline to the BBWAA as to what they think would be the proper way to go about voting for Hall of Famers, in particular now with the steroids issue that we're dealing with?
Bruce, that's a great question. I don't quite understand your vote. I'd love to hear your logic sometime. But
me too.
You know,
there is none.
It's funny that you asked this because you might actually have been there. This was 2015. Rob Manfred came up to ESPN for one of our February baseball summits. And we had a session with a small group of us and him on the record where I actually asked him that question. Give us some advice. How should we deal with the PED era players? And he actually gave it. He said that essentially there are two types of players. One group is players where he used the word proof, where you have players who tested positive and were disciplined, versus another group where, these are not his words, he said, you're basically just guessing. You think they did something. You suspect they did something. He said it's unfair to not vote for players in that second group who you're guessing. But players where you have proof, those are different. And A-Rod and Manny, it's not that hard to discern which group they would fit in. They're both multi-time offenders, right? So, if you follow his advice, it means...
They were dumber. They got caught.
right. But they played in an era where they knew they could get caught, where they knew there was testing. And if you get caught, there are consequences. I think withholding your Hall of Fame vote is an obvious consequence. I vote for Bonds. I vote for Clemens. I have never voted for Sammy, not one time. I've never voted for Manny, not one time. My ballot column hasn't run yet, so I'm not going to say whether I voted for A-Rod, but you could probably infer from the way I've answered this question what I think. I think that's a really reasonable way to go about this.
Yeah. Did you vote for Piazza?
Forward to that column. When will that run, Jason? Because everybody looks forward to that every year.
Well, my Hall of Fame ballot column, that's going to be on Friday. But before that, I think we decided it's going to run Tuesday. I did a long column just addressing all of the quote-unquote PED guys on the ballot and how we should think about them, how we it's clear from the voting we are thinking about them and how they don't all fit into one bucket. So Tuesday for that one, Friday for the ballot column.
Can't wait for those, and thank you so much for joining us this morning on Inside the Clubhouse.
Enjoy it, guys. Hope we actually see each other inside a clubhouse sometime.
It would be awesome. Take care, Jason.
Jason Stark, Hall of Fame baseball writer for The Athletic. Bruce, that a really good conversation. One of the smarter guys that covers the sport, whether he's talking about the Hall of Fame balloting or the impasse between the labor union and Major League Baseball. There's a lot of good stuff there.
Yeah, you didn't call him a curmudgeon or anything. I mean, he is 70 years old. I mean, you had the right to use curmudgeon.
We got 35 minutes left. I can call you all sorts of names when we come back. And when we do come back, John Lester might be the best Cub free agent signing ever. Maybe you disagree. Who's the White Sox best free agent signing ever? Who are the worst signings ever from the Cubs and the White Sox? Let us know. 312-644-6767. Call or text. We're here for you. Bruce Levine, David Haw, Inside the Clubhouse, Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score.
A little bit of a robust market early that we had some teams reach out. So it wasn't as stressful as it could have been. But I'm happy to land with the White Sox. Obviously, you look at their lineup, you look at what they bring to the table, and you look at their window of contention, and that's a huge deal to me. So you've got an opportunity to be part of that playoff group for the next 4, 5, 6 years, and that's what you want to do. You want to win a ring, and that's the biggest thing.
Welcome back inside the Clubhouse, Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score. David Hall, Bruce Levine until 11 o'clock. Yeah, that was Liam Hendricks' voice. Boy, is that good to hear. Talking baseball again. Boy, we would love to hear that soon as the sides still try to come together to end this lockout. Bruce, we're hearing from Liam Hendricks because he is a free agent signing by the White Sox. And in the context of John Lester's retirement, the conversation has veered toward, all right, he was the best Cubs free agent signing ever. Or was he? And then who was the White Sox best free agent signing ever? Is Liam Hendricks in the mix? Fun conversation, 312-644-6767. We're getting a lot of texts. What about your calls? Let us know who you think best and worst are. Bruce, I have mine. How would you list yours?
I'm going to add a second category to that, David.
Oh, no. We only have a half hour, Bruce.
I know, but I always...
Curmudgeon.
My topics are always about 3 to 4 hours and continue the next week as well.
Okay.
I'm going to ask your Chicago White Sox and Chicago Cub combination best and worst free agent signing.
Okay.
Okay. So for the Chicago White Sox, I'll get you started. For the Chicago White Sox, the best and worst free agent signing that I can ever remember was Albert Bell. Okay. Why was he the best? Look at his second year with the Chicago White Sox and look at the numbers that he put up.
All right.
They were spectacular, beyond spectacular, over 100 extra base hits,
right,
a record in doubles, 49 home runs. I mean, this is spectacular beyond any expectations of what they might think he would have added to the team. At the same time, he was a train wreck.
Okay.
A clubhouse disaster.
I like that category.
Didn't resonate with the fans. Had to be traded after that to the Baltimore Orioles in one of the best trades they ever made, just to get rid of him out of the south side of Chicago. And I don't demean him as a player. He was a fantastic hitter. I mean, one of the greatest of his time. But, you know, it just shows that you can be the best and the worst free agent signing all at the same time. I would venture to say on the north side, we could use the term Jason Hayward.
That's the same thing. It's the same idea. Jason Hayward, for 8 years, $184 million, was the absolute worst signing the Cubs have ever made. But you could also make your argument with sort of a twisted logic, but I get where you're going with it, Bruce. He was the
twisted
best.
Because it's me. Is that right, my friend?
Hey, your words, not mine. But listen, you can make the argument that Jason Hayward signing him puts you in a position to win the World Series because of his defense, because of his
without
leadership,
question.
Because of credibility.
Yeah, without question. I mean, just the speech alone during the rain delay for the World Series. But don't discount the quality individual, the quality teammate, the great defender winning multiple gold gloves, the guy that goes out there, whether he's good or bad, and gives you everything he has. This is a sign of a real professional, a great individual. His foundation here in Chicago, contributing to the west side of Chicago and doing fantastic things here. This can be the best and the worst. So, again,
it's one heck
my
of a speaker's
category.
Fee for Hayward.
Right. So there's my second category. But we want your category out there. And that is, who are your best and who are your worst Chicago White Sox and Cubs free agent signings? 312-644-6767. David, take it away.
The Score listener lines powered by BetQL. Bet smarter, beat the books. Download the BetQL app today. Visit BetQL.com. Before we get to our choices, let's go to Carl in Northfield. Carl, welcome to The Score.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Good.
I would say the best White Sox free agent had to be Carlton Fisk, because I think he played a lot of years with the White Sox, maybe 7-8 years longevity, and he was an
outstanding about 13 pitcher. 13 years.
Huh?
Yeah. How about 13 okay. years?
I would say Carlton Fisk was the best, and John Lester for the Cubs was their best.
Any
right.
any
Thank
nominations
you,
for the worst?
You know what? I guess there's so many of them. I really can't think at this point, Bruce. But I'm only going to go for the best of the best. But Pudge, if it wasn't for Pudge in 1983, I know we had a very good team, strong pitching. But you should ask that to Tony La Russa when spring training comes. What Carlton Fisk brought to the Chicago White Sox in 1983. He was an outstanding ball player, but I don't think his teammates liked him that much. I heard a lot of negativity about him being a teammate, but as a player, wonderful. Thanks, Bruce.
Thanks, Carl. Great phone call. Bruce, 13 years for the White Sox, as you point out, 11 years for the Red Sox. Signed with the Sox, the White Sox, in 1981, back in the day, 5 years, $2.9 million.
Not only that, it doesn't sound like a lot of money, but the White Sox were bought by Jerry Reinsdorf and Eddie Einhorn in that group at the same time, just 6 months before that, for something like $13 million. So put it in perspective of giving a free agent $2.9 million when you've just bought an entire franchise that's probably worth $1.5 billion to $2 billion right now for $13 million. He was certainly the best of quality. Carlton Fisk's teammates loved him, but there was, you know, Carlton had a different way that he went about his job. He was a different guy. He was from the East Coast. He had an in-your-face attitude. I love Carlton Fisk. I still do, because I like people with attitudes, even like you, David. You have
even
an
mine?
Attitude.
Okay, thank you, Bruce. You know who else was a big Carlton Fisk fan? Deion Sanders.
Yeah, he was. He was that one day, for sure. But in reality, you know, Fisk is, it was just, he like Lester, changed the way that the White Sox looked at themselves and the way that White Sox fans looked at themselves, you know, because from 1959 to 1983, no appearances in the playoffs. This was a huge changer for the Chicago White Sox in saying, we want to compete, we want to win.
Let's go to Doug, who is in Fairbury. Welcome to the Inside the Clubhouse, Doug.
Hey, thanks, guys. Great show. I'll make it quick. I agree with the last caller at Fisk. I'm going to show my age because I'm in the 60s. I'm going to throw two names out there. I don't know if they're a free agency or not. Bo Jackson and Dick Allen.
All right, Bruce, what do you think about those two?
Dick Allen was a trade. Yeah. I think Bo was a free agent signing. Is that not right? I think so.
I believe Bo Jackson was a free agent signing because he was playing football, and, right?
Right. Bo Jackson, I mean, great on a lot of different levels, average on some other levels because of the fact that he didn't play that long, but just the guts and the attitude of a guy for the first time in the history in sports, playing with a new hip, coming back and renewing his baseball career. I mean, to me, Bo Jackson is like the most unbelievable athlete and human specimen that I've ever seen in my entire life. And if you watched him play college football or professional football, you saw a guy that there were 21 other guys out there, and then there was Bo Jackson.
Yes, and 16 days after the Royals released him in 1991, he signed with the White Sox. So I guess that technically is a free agent, a three-year deal guaranteeing him $700,000 per season with incentives. He could have reached up to $8.1 million. Bo Jackson is a good one, even though he didn't play a long time for the White Sox. He was spectacular in his brief stay on the South Side, and he still remains loyal to the organization, Bruce. I think he's a big fan, and maybe it's partly because – you know, after he was released, they gave him a landing spot.
312-644-6767. Up until the end of the show, David and I will take your calls. The best and the worst free agent signings for your Chicago teams.
I haven't given you mine yet because I think that Carlton Fisk is an interesting choice and understandable for people of a certain age. I think the White Sox most significant free agent signing was A.J. Pierzynski for the same reasons. For the same reasons, I think when you look at what that meant to winning, and Fisk came in 81 and they won in 83, but they didn't win at all. And I don't want to necessarily quibble between length of time on the South Side or whatever, but in this modern baseball, the one-year, $2.25 million contract the Sox signed A.J. Pierzynski to when he came to town created a culture – and he shook things up. They needed him at the right – he was the right guy at the right time. I don't know if they win in 2005 without him. I think A.J. Pierzynski, to me, was the best White Sox signing ever. John Lester for the Cubs. The worst for me, Cubs, Milton Bradley, White Sox, Adam Dunn. Sorry, Adam Dunn.
Well, I'm probably going with a guy that I really like and have a lot of respect for as the worst White Sox signing, and that would be – right-handed pitcher Jamie Navarro, a four-year contract where Jamie was always a guy that took the ball, and a lot of times people didn't want him to take the ball because he was a guy that came over from the Cubs as a free agent, a 16-game winner with the Cubs, doing great things over there with Fergie Jenkins as his head coach, as his pitching coach, came over, and for 4 years – was not able to be a winner, but took the ball every day and showed up. You know, that was a really bad signing, and it left a bad taste in the mouth of the White Sox people, because if you remember, Jerry Reinsdorf is the one that pretty much laid it out there very early in the 80s and later in the early 90s with the Jack McDowell situation, that the White Sox were not going to sign people to 5-, 6-, and 7-year contracts that are pitchers, because history and medical science showed that they are just not going to show up being able to do that job after a certain amount of time in the big leagues on their 30 plus years. After pitching at 30, it's downhill from there. So he stuck to that, but he did allow Ron Shuler to sign Jamie Navarro, and they regretted it.
Okay, that is the worst White Sox or worst signing. How about the Cubs?
For the Cubs, I would. It's kind of a toss up, but I would say, and again, wonderful lineage, wonderful guy, horrible player. Todd Hundley of the Chicago Cubs was their worst free agent signing. Todd, Randy Hundley, one of my favorite people. Todd Hundley, a really good guy. Todd had a lot of challenges, okay? He had personal demons. He had issues that he had to deal with. He was not able to put all his concentration and all his energy in his baseball career when he was here with the Chicago Cubs. If you remember, Todd set a record for catchers hitting 42 home runs for the New York Mets. Wonderful catcher, wonderful hitter. But, personally, I still feel for Todd and the challenges he went through, but it was a horrible signing that just didn't work out.
Well, I have to quibble with that a little bit because I think the Cubs had one that was even worse, and I can remember why firsthand. We also want to hear from Doug. We want to hear from Bob. We want to hear from you. 312-644-6767, the best and worst free agent signings for the Cubs and White Sox. Going way back here on Inside the Clubhouse, Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score. Welcome back Inside the Clubhouse, Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score. Best and worst free agent signings. Bruce Levine, David Haw here for another segment. Got some good text, Bruce. 309 says Jason Hayward was the worst. 708 gives a shout-out to Adam Eaton. 773, Ron Bloomberg, for people who can remember him back in the day, Bruce. And let's get out to the phone lines. Doug,
what's he famous for, David?
Ron Bloomberg? Was he the first designated hitter?
Yes. It's a 50-year anniversary. We're going to get him on sometime in the next week or so.
That's a great idea. So is getting to Doug, who is in – oh, Bob is in Cicero. I'm sorry. Bob, welcome to The Score.
Hello, man. Anyway, speaking of demons, how about the Cubs and Milton Bradley?
Yeah,
great one.
Pick,
2009, okay. $30 million, Bruce. That was Jim Hendry's worst mistake.
Yeah, well, you're both – I'm gonna trump that with a Fukudome for you.
Do you still have the T-shirt, Bruce? Be honest.
You know, he wasn't that bad the first year. Remember, he broke out. He had a homer in his first game as a Cub, I believe.
Yeah.
Opening day,
yeah.
And it was like, oh, warning track power. You know, the home runs that he hit 30 home runs in Japan. He hit, you know, like 12 or, you know, 10. He was just so mediocre. It was just a very, very tough one. So that would be on the list too, I think.
Okay, that's a long list, unfortunately. Let's go to Doug in Decatur. Hey, Doug.
Hey, guys. Love the show.
Thank you.
I'm going with the Cubs. My best signing is Andre Dawson, and my worst is Danny Jackson.
Oh, I like the Danny Jackson, Bruce. Ooh. He was a joy to cover, wasn't he?
Yikes. Jim Fry signed a bunch of guys when you're Danny Jackson, Dave Smith, the closer, and very few of them worked out. That was in 1990, I believe, after they won the division 89 with the lowest payroll in baseball, $11 million. And then they went out and spent a ton and got nothing out of it.
Bruce, fact or fiction that Andre Dawson was handed a blank check to say – Or did he hand the Cubs a blank check? How did that work?
He handed it to the Cubs. He gave him, hopefully we'll have Andre on next week, talk Hall of Fame.
Okay.
He handed Dallas Green he said, we're signing with the Cubs. It's a blank contract. You fill in the amount. Dallas Green couldn't stop smiling until he wrote in $500,000 at that time. Andre went on to do what? He won the MVP in 1987 that same year. He got $150,000 in bonuses. But, you know, the average salary for a superstar back then was $3 million. So, it was.
That's
go ahead,
amazing.
Dave.
No, he signs a blank check and Milton Bradley signs a blankety blank check. I mean, that's the kind of thing that we talk about. the differences in the two, the disparities. Look, I don't want to pick on Adam Dunn, Bruce, but let's get into that for a moment. 2011, he came for big money. I mean, that was a big contract. Ozzie Guillen's last season, 4 years, $56 million. He hits 11 homers, 42 runs batted in. I don't care if he made the All-Star team the next year. The expectations were soaring in 2011 when he signed.
I will raise you an Adam LaRoche.
That's pretty good.
I'm going to jump on that and raise you an Adam LaRoche for many different reasons, other than the fact that he decided he didn't want to finish his career with the White Sox. He walked away from free agent money here, you know, going on to some other ventures in life. His son was still the most important guy that was never signed by the White Sox.
Yeah, Drake, the leader in the clubhouse. And Bruce, what price can you put on leadership? Really? It's priceless stuff that he provided.
David, we have a lot of people to thank today, including Cesar, who did a fantastic job of producing as he always does. You go ahead with the rest.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun today. I enjoyed talking to Jason Stark. I thought he was really insightful and the content that he provided from the senior baseball writer for The Athletic. Jesse Sanchez got us going in the first hour with the news on the international signing period opening today. The White Sox get Oscar Colas for $2.7 million. And thank you to everyone for participating in the program, especially you, Bruce. You brought it today. I really appreciate that. It was a lot of fun.
People can follow me on MLB Bruce Levine on Twitter and on our website, 670thescore.com, writing Cubs and Sox. When we would start having some baseball again, until that, it's labor conversation. But we will talk baseball here every Saturday. Looking forward to next Saturday already, David.
Me too, and I'm also looking forward to Saturday Suckage. Mark Grody, Steve Rosenblum, 11 until 2. Then we got the NFL playoffs, and hey, Bulls on the score tonight. They try to bounce back from that two back-to-back blowout losses. That pregame here on the score with Chuck and Bill, 6:45. Thank you for listening. Inside the Clubhouse, Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Baseball is back, and so is MLB.tv. Watch every out-of-market, regular season game on your favorite streaming devices. Anywhere, anytime, all season long. Follow the action live or on demand. Track four games at once with multi-view mode and catch up with in-game highlights. Plus, original programs, minor league broadcasts, and local pre- and post-game shows. Go to MLB.tv to start your free trial today. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.